Speaker tonight is a buddy of mine who I've known for a while, actually, and I've always wanted to hear his story. I can't stand it when people get up here and give a lot of fluff about how spectacular the person is and, you know, how they're spiritual. The one thing I do know about this gentleman is that he's always extending himself to help other people and carry the message, and that's exactly what this program asks us to do. And I don't see many people doing it with that much regularity, and this person does a tremendous amount. And with that, I'd like to introduce Cap.
My name's Cap. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is May 10th, 2000, and my home group is the Complete Abandon Group that meets over at the Biscayne Room. And I grew up in Los Angeles, and it was I had fun. It was a good place to grow up. I had a good time. My dad passed away when I was about six, and my mom raised four kids. I'm the youngest. I had an older brother and two older sisters, and the oldest brother and sister were out of the house as far as I can remember. But in the time period, kids were experimenting with drinking and smoking pot and whatnot, and I joined in on that. I don't know, I was maybe 13 or 14, and bought this big, huge bag of weed, and I was smoking it, and nothing happened, and then I remember I had smoked some of it with somebody that had something better than what I had, and it hit me, and I was just in awe about how good I felt and how relaxed I was. It wasn't but a couple weeks after that, another friend of mine had some beer and some vodka. Ever since I was a kid, my mom had bought me these little 1 ounce, or the 2 ounce bottles, whatever they were, those little decorative bottles. They looked like the big bottles, but they were tiny, and every time she'd go somewhere on vacation, she'd get me these little bottles, and I had this collection in an aquarium, I remember, these little bottles. That night I went out drinking with the guys, that seemed to be the real deal, not only did I feel good, but I could communicate. And I was relaxed, it seems, and it didn't seem like I really was out of control. And I went home, and there wasn't any repercussion, and there wasn't any real consequences or anything like that. And I wanted to do that more. And of course, I drank all the little bottles. Slowly they were all empty. I was very careful to pull the little labels off and put them back on there. So my folks wouldn't know that I drank them all. But, drugs are part of my story. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I would do speed, because I could, these little white cross tops or something we call them, you could buy a bag of them for next to nothing. And you could drink a lot more on them. And the first time I drank with my parents around was my eldest sister's wedding, and I had a blast. I had a champagne fountain, and I was just going to drain that thing. I remember just singing, walking back to the car, and talking to my parents like we're just pals, or my mom, like we're just buddies, And of course, I passed out, and she thought, "That's good. He won't do that anymore." And she didn't know that I was already, well on my way. At 15, I was arrested at Malibu Beach. I'd figured out that you could go to the store down the road. There was I forget what market it was, and you could steal liquor, fairly easily. And so I would steal a bottle of liquor, and I went back to the beach, and I'm drinking with this girl on the beach, and we run out, and of course, I'll get more. I go back to the beach, and I come back, and what they had been doing is they've been like kind of like scoping out the beach from up on top of the cliffs behind there, you know, the police with you know, just with telescopes and binoculars and figuring out who they're going to nail, you know, and they went and swooped in after I went to the store, and I came back, and this what I remember of this incident is this girl with her arm twisted up to the back of her neck and them like hitting her head on the hood of the car. That's probably not what happened. That's what I remember. And everybody standing there all solemn watching this, just this big crowd of people that were on the beach. And of course I run right up to the front of the crowd and start cussing the cops and flipping them off, and the next thing you know there's rocks flying, and the cop signals me out and grabs me and throws me in the back of the car, and that's my first like arrest, you know. And they were pissed, and it was like inciting a riot, insult with a deadly weapon on a police officer with the intent to kill, and I don't know, maybe something else, I don't remember. And I got this really bad attorney, you know, this public defender, and of course I was guilty and it wasn't my fault, and you know, I wouldn't even claim the part that I did do, you know. It was like it wasn't my fault, I'm innocent. And you know, I did a lot of that for years afterwards. But it all worked out, you know, there was some fine to pay, and you know, my mom was upset, of course, and I had a stepdad at the time, and he'd been with my mom for a long time, like 20 something years, but I resented him, of course, because he wouldn't let me manipulate her like I could normally, so I didn't really like him much. And I could manipulate my mom pretty well. I dropped out of school. I wasn't very good at that. Drinking was more important. And this was probably around the ninth grade. And you know, my mom was doing her best to try to get me some help. And I was maybe 16. And I wasn't having any of it. You know, I figured if they just leave me alone, I'd be all right. You know, I mean, the problem was if they get off my back. And I, you know, of course, I could never make it home on time. I couldn't be responsible for anything. And somehow, I had this idea in my mind. You know, I just this total delusional idea of reality. You know, like there wasn't any consequences ever to be paid. And if I was out of their house, it would even be better. And of course, they helped me with that. They kicked me out, and then I was staying at friends' houses. And there was a friend of mine, and his parents took me in for a little while, and so on and so forth. That went on for a while, and you know, I had these bad jobs, and one friend of mine's dad gave me this job, and as a residential electrician, and it was the only thing I had that made me feel like I was human still. You know, like I was still part of the human race somehow. You know, because I just didn't feel right about anything. I didn't feel right about myself or anybody around me, and I just, you know, I couldn't seem to have relationships with other people at all. You know, and it went on like that. There was a lot of weird little things, you know. There was time I got arrested in Chicago visiting my grandparents, and you know, for stealing a truck, and we were just going to the store to get beer, and you know, these guys stole it. I didn't have anything to do with it, of course, you know. And they beat us up, and I'm in jail again. And I hitchhiked to Chicago, you know, to clear my name, you know. And it's ridiculous, you know. And I go into court, and it's a big drawn out thing. And the judge goes, "You hitchhike here?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "Well, get your stuff and leave." You know, I mean, they didn't even, you know, I guess they figure if you're going to do that, yeah, you can go. And I really didn't have much to do with it. And the people that did, when they saw me there, left. So, you know, but I was drunk, and because of that fact, you know, it got me in with those people. And you know, that's where I ended up always, you know. For some reason, I went that direction. And I went back home, and I had some other, I found a bunch of weed on the side of the road growing, and I took everything out of my knapsack or my backpack and stuffed it full of that. And I thought it was a gift from God because I was broke, and went into L.A. and sold it and bought more drugs and drank and went crazy. And my parents took me back in. And this time they called AA, and they said, I'm like 19 now, and they call AA. And I agreed to go. And this guy named Nick Starner came and picked me up. And he brought me to AA. He gave me a big book. And I remember he signed the front of it, "From the Love of One Alcoholic to Another." And I was like, what the hell is he talking about? I had no idea what that meant, but I was scared of this guy now. And I went to AA for a little while, and I tried to listen, and I got a lot of what a lot of young people I'm sure still get, and that was, you're too young, you're too this, you're too that. And I wanted to believe all that. But I qualified then. I just wouldn't accept anybody I wouldn't allow anybody to really help me, Nobody really put their hand down, and I didn't really put my hand out for help either, And consequently, after a couple of months, I drank, and I went out again. And of course, my parents, it was the same thing with them. They're enabling me to continue this way. And my mom, I just remembered this a couple of weeks ago. This is kind of interesting, right? She got really upset, and she just was at a loss with what to do. And she goes into the bathroom and slams the door, and I say, "What are you doing?" And I'm pounding on the door, and she, "I don't hear anything." And I kick the door in, and she's cut her wrists. And I grab all these razor blades, and I have them in my hand, and I'm thinking, that bitch, she cut her wrists, and she's going to blame me. And I left, and nothing ever was said about that again. My stepfather took her to the hospital. And they sewed her up, and of course, my mom had her own problems. I suspect that she was one of us, but my stepdad drew the line with her. She was drunk once, and he said, "If you're ever like that again, I'm leaving. I'm not going to have it." And so I suspect, and I could be wrong. She's not with us anymore, so I don't know. But I suspect she had a drinking problem, and it never got addressed. And I can see some of that now, but I couldn't then. And I just never thought about it. I never gave it a second thought. We never talked about it again. And I just thought, once again, look what she's doing to me. Instead of, being concerned for my mother's welfare, this woman who's raised me and, took care of me as a child, and I'm all I can think about is myself and how they're going to blame it on me, how crazy is that? And so I'm back on the street again, and my stepdad kicks me out, that SOB. And later on I had a chance to talk to him about that, and I told him that I recognized that he loved her enough to kick me out of the house, and that I understood that. So I'm living on the streets in an alley in a car by now, and I'm tattooing a little bit. That's my new trade. It's easy. People pay you for it. And you can stay drunk. So it's a beautiful thing. But I've somehow ended up in this alley in a car. I don't know how it happened, but there I was. And it was getting more difficult to tattoo. People don't want to go to a car for tattoos. So I end up back in A, and it's my car. And someday that sucker's going to run. So I'm not as bad as the other guys, And I go to AA, and I'm pretty whooped. There was a couple of things that happened that were a chain of events that happened during this time. I did have the car, and some other bum actually started living in it. So I met this guy, and he let me stay in his backyard in a tent, and he gave me speed and beer. And I worked around his house, and he got mad at me for for talking about one of his friends, and he just decked me, you know. And I remember, I still to this day, this eye twitches, you know, where this guy just plowed me in the head a good one. And I'm sitting on the curb with a bottle of rum, and I'm thinking, this has got to end. You know, I mean, everybody had told me, you know, time and time again, you know, I've had people come up to me and say, you know, Cap, nobody likes a drunk, you know. I mean, you're a good guy, and, you know, you like people, you know, you like to have a lot of fun, and that, you know, da-da-da-da-da, but you're drunk, you know. I mean, there's a time when you gotta, nobody likes that, you know, but something about that, you know, in the head, you know, and sitting on the curb, you know, I had some depth and weight. You know, I was thinking about my condition a little bit, you know. Maybe I had to look into this. So I wander around all night, you know, and it's cold, and I got nowhere to go, and I knew there was this, it was like a barn. It wasn't like a halfway house, per se. It was kind of like a barn, and people in AA ran it, and there's, you know, like 20 beds on the top of this barn, and 20 beds on the bottom, and I get into this place, and I'm going to this meeting place in the San Fernando Valley called the Hole in the Sky, and I don't feel comfortable there. And this woman goes, "Have you ever been to the Nest?" And I said, "No." And she says, "Well, you might be more comfortable at the Nest." And she gives me an address, and it's on Reseda Boulevard and Sherman Way, and I go down there, and it's upstairs, and there's a bunch of motorcycles out front, and the gal reading the 12 steps is like loaded on heroin or something, you know. So, and I'm like, they sent me over here? Yeah. These people? Yeah, I kind of like that a little bit, you know, because I was kind of a street guy. It was an interesting place. It was like one of these AA places, and I'm sure some of you probably know what I'm talking about, where there's a lot of people on the edge of AA. You know, and nobody really, really wanting to get involved. But it's a place for guys like me to be able to hang on to the edge, you know. And I did that. I hung on to the edge of AA, and there was a core group there that was really involved. There was a group of people that were trying to make some difference in that place. And I remember them, and I remember making fun of them. You know, because I didn't have to do all that. You know, I mean, I wasn't drinking, and I was going to AA meetings, and I was okay. I had some different ideas on sobriety. You know, I mean, people were, you know, talking about faith and, you know, developing a relationship with God and all this kind of stuff, and I really wasn't interested in any of that. My problem was that I ended up on the streets through a series of events that didn't have much to do with that, but you know, with my drinking and stuff, and maybe a little bit, you know. I mean, you know, right away, you know, I'm backpedaling on this thing. You know, it's funny because I hear people in AA and they talk about moments of clarity and hitting bottom, and I've had a lot of moments of clarity, a lot of them. Some of them substantial, some of them that made me really think, and some of them that I just got over. And I've had a lot of bottoms, really good ones, really good bottoms. And I came to AA, and I would figure out why I was different, why my case was a little different than everyone else's, and I was a little cooler and a little slicker, and that I really didn't belong there. But I did know one thing, and that was if I went to AA, I didn't drink. And so I went to AA, and I didn't drink, and I got a little group of friends that were kind of on the edge like me. And we proceeded to do things that we'd go back to AA, and there would be people saying, "Well, this is what you do to get sober." And then and I'd say, "Well, no, you don't have to do this. Look what I've done, and I didn't drink." I would like push the envelope all the way to the edge, you know, about what I could get away with and not drink. And I didn't drink. You know, I mean, I was psychotic, and, you know, and I had these really bad relationships with people still, and nothing seemed to really come together in my life. And I thought, well, a woman will fix it, you know, so I'm in a series of really screwed up relationships with women, and it's just horrible. And And a couple of people tried to reach out and help me, because there are people in AA that do that, you know, that see that happening, and they go, "Wait a minute, kid, stop. Look, you might not make it if you do this." And I would go, "You're wrong. I'm fine." You know, I mean, I didn't understand the nature of how this disease works on me, and how. You know, I just, it's a funny thing. It's a funny thing how I convinced myself that I was okay. And I believed that, you know. I mean, I lived up to that point with this, you know, I had this, you know, I was talking to this guy about it yesterday, actually. We were talking about how, you know, we see the world, you know, as newcomers, and this kind of like this chemical veil. And then we come to AA, and people say, "Well, this is what you do." And we go, "Well, I can't see how that could really affect me and helping my life any." And so I got to thinking, what I really needed is I needed money, and I needed stability. If I had stability, if I could manage to have stability, I'd be good. So I worked really hard to get stability in my life. I got a job in New Mexico where I could make a lot of money. And I went there, and I made a lot of money, and I worked really hard. I worked long days, and everybody I knew there was in AA, because I joined this bike club. And it was a bunch of guys that were in AA, and they weren't drinking, and they were riding motorcycles, and I got involved in that instead of AA. And so there was a fellowship of people that didn't drink. Some of them didn't. It seemed to get worse as time went on. But it man, you know, I could hang on to the edge that way, you know, and not drink and not use, and I did that, and it worked for a little while. The only problem is that whole thing just really, my ego and my arrogance and my pride just loved it, you know, just rolled around in it, and I got sicker and sicker. You know, the whole time this is going on, I'm getting worse. I have no idea, because now I'm kind of convinced that it's sort of like, you know, it was good. It helped me when I needed it. You know, that's what I'd say to people. "Well, you know, when I was, you know, having a really rough time with AA, you know, I mean, you know, I had this gap, you know, I was beginning to try to make with AA." And anyway, when I moved to New Mexico, there was a couple friends of mine that were still active, that were actively involved in AA. And they would say, "Cap, let's go to AA." And I'd go, and I couldn't relate at all anymore. I sat there, and I went at a meeting, and I just felt, I don't belong here with these people, period. And I, like I said, I worked really hard, and you know, 5-6 days a week, and you know, more, less and less was I around people that had anything to do with recovery. And I thought the world was out to get me, and I drank. And I had met my wife at the time. I thought she was normal, because I was looking for one of these normal women outside of AA, you know, that didn't drink, because all those girls in AA are screwed up. And of course, I hook up with my wife, and I remember the motivation kind of behind it is she worked really hard, and she had a daughter that's I've adopted now, Jasmine, and Jazzy was 3, and my wife was 18, and she paid the rent and for child support pretty much. She supported this kid, and I just thought how impressive that was to me for an 18-year-old to work like that, and you know. But I don't know, you know, I believe in doctor. I was listening to Dr. Bob, his story on tape, and he's talking about how we tend to find the best, how alcoholics find the best mates, and I believe that, you know, because she turned out to be an alcoholic too, but we had the best codependent relationship for a long time, and it was sick, and we stayed together, and we moved here. You know, I mean, when I started drinking, at this point it had been 6 years. It was 10 years before I drank. I was 31 when I started drinking again. So I didn't drink for that period of time, but I did nothing to be involved in here. And I ended up being out for 8 years. My intention was to go out for one night. I was angry about something, and I was going to go out for one night. And I remember it was well planned, and I thought about it, and I thought it'll be all right. A long time's passed, and it'll be okay. And it won't be like it was, you know, years before. You know, I'll be able to manage it better. Because hadn't I proven that I could manage pretty good? And that I wouldn't let it get to me like that. And and I worked for 6 years and saved a lot of money. Within 3 months, I'd spent 2/3 of that money. And we packed up the We packed up the truck and moved to Beverly. No, we came down. We ended up coming here. We were going to go through Atlanta and go up to Florida. And I had some dream about tattooing in Florida and all this kind of stuff. And so we were going that way, and we ended up here. I don't know how it happened. Divine intervention. I believe that now. And so I opened the shop, and the city was really horrible about it, and I stayed drunk. It's the only, you know, so it's the only way I could deal with this. You know, I was just drunk all the time. And then I, moving here, I discovered, actually in New Mexico, I discovered that I could do drugs and nobody could smell booze on me. So that I could wean myself off alcohol and take drugs. And so for years, that's what happened. Back and forth. Detoxing myself off of drugs and then becoming a drunk and then detoxing myself that way. And this went on. And I got some acclaim in my business too. I mean, I had gained. I was on the top of the heap in my business. You know, I was on TBS. You know, on some special. I went to Australia, and guys were going, "Didn't I see you on TV last week, mate?" And it was, you know, does that sound like an alcoholic? You know, I mean, I don't know. You know, it was weird, and. So before I came in, I was sick again, and I was drinking, and I was taking drugs, and it was on, and I couldn't stop now. It had been that way for about 3 months, where I couldn't stop. It was just, I'd reached a place where it was unstoppable. And I thought I was doing a pretty good job of putting on a front about it, but everybody knew. And I was packing to go to a business trip to New York. I was packing my bag, ready to go. And my wife sits down on the couch and she says, "I think you're dying and I'm preparing for that. I just thought I'd let you know." And walked away. And I was like, That could be happening. You know, because there were some different things going on with my body. I tended to, you know, I'd get worn out walking about 20 feet. And, you know, I had all this fluid build up in my legs from my liver shutting down. And there's some signs that there's physical stuff going on, and that could equal death. And I had a friend of mine who kind of dabbled in AA, because I knew a lot of people still, of course, that were on the edge of this thing. I never really, those are the people I was attracted to. But he helped save my life, this guy, because my wife was sober at that time for 2 years. And she was pretty pissed off, and she was in denial of my condition. And she doesn't remember saying that day. But I remember it clearly. And she was very upset, you know. I mean, it was becoming, she was beginning to realize just how in denial she was of the condition I was in. And she took our daughter, and she goes, "I don't know what you're going to do." I came clean with her. And I said, "Look, I'm sick, and you're right, I don't know what to do." You know, and I called this guy, and he said he'd come sit with me. And she left town, went to Athens for a couple of days. She goes, "I'm not going to go through this, and I'm not going to let Jasmine go through this either." And she left, and he came and sat on the couch while I got sick. And I went from couch to couch, and from bedroom and the floor. You know, it was kind of like reminiscent of the Three Little Bears. You know, I just remember, "This surface is way too hard." You know, I go to, "This is way too soft." You know. It's way too hot in here. You know, I mean, just, you know, all shaking and sick. And I rolled in. It was like the third day without a drink. I couldn't even really sit up. And a friend of mine took me over to this guy that helped save my life. He took me over there. He's drinking right now. He's out experimenting some more. I don't think I'd have made it through that one day and that one night without somebody just being there, just a presence of another person in that room. I don't think I'd have made it. And the third day I went into AA, and I got sat on the couch at the Biscayne, and couches was beautiful because I could lay back and not feel like I was going to vomit. And this guy comes up to me. And he's talking to me about AA, and I already in my mind I thought, you know, I got to do something different around here. I got to get a sponsor, and I got to find out about this God thing. You know, I got to hook into this right away. And I knew I couldn't wait too long to get a sponsor because I had some experience with what happens to me when I wait. I wander around and I start listening to people and I think, oh, maybe that guy will be a good sponsor. And then I go and check him out, you know, take his resume, you know, listen to him at meetings and that guy can't help me. He's clearly more screwed up than me. And then starts another, you know, cycle where I work myself out of AA gradually. I mean, by this time, the idea of what I think of AA and what goes on in these rooms isn't reality at all. It's a delusional idea of what AA is. I mean, I have no grasp of what this thing is, but I think I do. I think I've done it. And so I get this guy, he's talking to me, and it's the strangest thing, because this guy knows exactly where I'm at, you know. I couldn't believe it. And I know this, I've had to have this experience before, but not like this time. This time this guy was like talking to me, and I was like, yeah, man, that's it. You know. And I thought, I'll ask this guy. So, you know, of course I say, you know, I need a sponsor. And he goes, oh, you do? Well, maybe you ought to ask somebody. And so I said, well, will you be my sponsor? And he says, yeah, sure. I'll sponsor you. I'll help you. You know, but what are you willing to do? And of course, I was really sick. I'm willing to do anything. You know, you hear the, whatever you suggest. I'll rawr, you know. And I had no idea what I was getting myself into with this guy. And he started to help me to get better around here. He got me to show up And I had a lot of reasons why I didn't have to show up. I mean, I had this family, you know, and my daughter, of course. But she's like, you know, 14 at the time. And the only time I was ever there was when I was loaded or drunk. So I got this idea, well, I'm sober now. It's been 5 minutes. And a couple of days or whatever, or a week or two. I don't know what it was. But I was fighting. I was fighting having to go to these meetings every night. Because he wanted me to go to AA every night. And I had a lot of important business, and he changed the hours I worked. I mean, I got my own business, right? I mean, I come here and I started this business and all this, and these were all very things I was very proud of. And he says, yeah, well, you know, the hours you work and all that, you know, how are you ever going to stay sober? You know, so change your hours, you know, work from 10 to 5. I'll work from 1 till 2 in the morning. And I said, and I was working by appointments, and I could do that. You know, so I did that. He goes, you need to go to 8 o'clock meetings. You know, 8 o'clock's prime time AA, man. You need to be there, 8 o'clock, every night. And I said, all right, well, I'll do that. And I remember I talked to him, and I was really concerned that I wasn't spending enough time with my wife. And I said, look, I'm going to have to cut back on these meetings, you know, so that I can spend some time with my wife. He says, Cappy, if you're not sober, I mean, what difference is it making? I said, look, what if she leaves? You know, I'm scared, and I'm thinking, she's going to leave, I'm going to lose everything, I worked really hard for this. Of course, by that time, she was running the whole show anyway, you know. Anything I thought I was doing there was just purely make-believe. And he said, well, look, what happens if she leaves, like you think, you know, and you do lose everything, you know, and she, you think you're going to be sober through that? And I couldn't stay sober. I knew I couldn't stay sober anymore. There was no more, I was no longer in any delusion about my condition. And he helped me to see that because I didn't have any ability to see that at all. It was funny. The other day I was having lunch with a friend of mine, and he's in the top of his field in the medical profession. And this guy calls me on the phone, and he says, I need help. You know, he'd gone out again, and will you help me? And I said, yeah, you know, I told him to meet me at a meeting later on that day. And I got off the phone, and I says, you know, I said, this guy, he's, you know, he just can't seem to gather any time together. You know, he's an alcoholic and a drug addict, you know. And he goes, oh, yeah, those guys, they're screwed. You know, what happens, you know, because he's telling me the medical twist on it. He's saying, you know, what happens in the body is that, you know, it doesn't get the proper distribution of chemicals, you know, because of the, you know, the chemicals that are being taken into the body cut off the natural body's flow and the brain's ability to get what it needs. And once somebody stops, it's almost impossible for them to stay sober, you know, and clean. And I was just thinking, wow, how about that, you know? Whew. Hopeless. You know, and that's me. You know, that's me. Somehow my mind would continue to tell me that I wasn't hopeless, that I was a little bit different, and it always did that. And this guy got me to get involved, get on a spiritual path. You know, he helped me to be able to see that that's the case with me. Guys like me are hopeless, and we die. That's what we do. And you know, without the help of God, we don't have a chance at licking this thing. And so I allowed him to help me get on a spiritual path because I didn't know anything about that. I always thought I had this idea of what God was that was good. And, you know, there's a positive force and a negative force, and you could tap into either one of them. You know, some kind of crazy, mystical, too much thinking going on path of, you know, self-absorbed spirituality or some crap, you know. And his idea was different. See, his idea was, you know, you need to take the time to pray and sit quiet and read some spiritual material every day, Cap. And you need to help somebody like you, you know. And he started me doing that right away. And I was very fortunate, you know, because about 3 months without a drink, a guy that I was sponsoring stayed sober for a while. And he's still sober. And I took him as far as I could. And then my sponsor said, that's all you can do for him. And now you have to tell him to get another sponsor. And luckily he asked my sponsor to be his sponsor. So we still do AA together. And it's good. But there's been a bunch of guys like him. And some of them stick around and some of them don't. The thing that ran home to me is the seriousness of my condition. That I'm just like all these guys, you know what I mean? A lot of them go out again. You know, I never noticed that when I was in AA before because I never would try to help anyone. I either was too well, you know, and of course I recognize now that I never did AA. You know, my experience was that I didn't do any AA. It was funny, one day I was talking to my sponsor and I was recognizing what was happening in AA. I was looking around the room and I could feel this thing. And I'm telling my sponsor about it, you know, and he goes, and I says, you know, I never felt that before. And he goes, that's because you were like a newcomer for 10 years. But each of these guys have brought me closer to the truth about myself and allowed me to be able to see some of the truths about what's going on. And, you know, the Big Book talks about, you know, what happens when we work hard at this thing. And that how, you know, if we keep close to them and perform his work well, that we'll have a new employer. When my sponsor allowed me to read that in the book, I knew what that meant at that time, and I never experienced anything like that. But it was all from them guys. It was a funny thing. My son was visiting me, and this guy, we're getting off the freeway at the 85 in Claremont, and there's this guy, and he's stumbling from one telephone pole to a light pole, and he's having a really difficult time. And I turn to my son and I say, he's going to the VA. He's got alcoholism and he's like dying. And my son goes, how could you know that, Dad? And so I whipped a U-turn and rolled down the window and said, hey, you going to the VA? And he's like, yeah. I said, well, get in the back, you know. And he's whimpering, getting in the back seat. You know, and it reminded me like when I was a little kid and I would have like the flu or something just really bad. And I would make these whimpering noises just hoping she would comfort me for a moment, you know. Just to feel better, you know. That's what it reminded me of, this guy getting in the back of my car, you know, and he's holding on to his liver. And I said, so you got a drinking problem? And he says, yeah. And I said, he goes, I haven't had a drink in 6 months. And I could smell liquor on him. So, you know, he's one of us for sure. And I said, you ever try AA? And he said, yeah, it's just, you know, one of them self-help programs, you know. And see, that's how it was for me. That's how I thought of AA when I came in here. My mind had slowly worked this miraculous thing that happens in these rooms, made it into some kind of like supplement to my life. You know, because this is not a supplement to my life. I mean, this is more than that. This is this thing has become the most important thing, and my family recognizes that, and I don't neglect my responsibilities with work, and I don't neglect my responsibilities with my wife and my daughter. As a matter of fact, I think we probably have a better relationship than we've ever had, and that's something. You know, it's a funny thing, because just from working at this, all of a sudden I'm like treating people a little bit better, and of course, you know, I've treated the world pretty bad, so I'm trying to like make amends a little bit to the world by not doing that. And you know, the people that I've worked with have just tolerated intolerable stuff from me, and I treat them a little bit better. I let them know who's boss still, but I treat them much better and work with them because I want them around. And you know, none of them have a drinking problem. They all have, like, you know, these little houses and families, and they want to spend time with them, and they, you know, and it's a really interesting thing. You know, I mean, I could never see any of that stuff before, you know, and it's the same with my home life, and I have been blessed with a sponsor that has been patient, and just really, really knows this disease, and really knows how to be helpful, and I feel just so fortunate for that. Because I like I said earlier, you know, I mean, I came here and I believed that was God's deal, you know. I ended up here, I didn't like it here, I don't want to be here. And I think God knew that if I wasn't here, I wouldn't get sober. I wouldn't have a chance. You know, and that guy was there to help me. And you people, you know, have all been put into my life. And it's nothing I've done. It isn't any special thing that I've done. It's something that's beyond all that. And I'm grateful for that, and I try to show that, you know. And you know, the big book talks about you know, faith being a process of you know, to be vital, you know, to have to come from selfish, unselfish, constructive action. And my sponsor, you know, helps me to this day, you know, all the time, because I still work with a bunch of guys always, and I get places and I don't know what's going on, and he helps me to be able to see what's happening and different things. And I'd like to think that I don't have any reservations or anything like that, that's all over, but this has been a really gradual process for me, and I see them through those guys, you know. You know, and the whole thing about faith and all that, you know, I'd like to think that I got this, you know, real handle on that. And the truth is that there's evidence in my life that that's not the truth. And so I got to keep working at this. And I think, you know, I got a chance. You know, I got a chance to stay sober if I keep it up. You know, I won't forget where I came from and take God's grace for granted again. And thanks for listening to me.